Hi, you're listening to Manufactured, a podcast about sustainability and the making of fashion. I'm your host, Kim van der Weert, a student of human rights, turned garment factory manager, turned sustainable fashion critic. On this show, I talk to some of the most integral people who manufacture what we wear. They aren't the people you see in fashion magazines, they're the people behind closed doors working in fashion supply chains. On the one hand, people often talk about legislation and regulation as if it's the golden ticket out of fashion sustainability problems. The logic goes something like this. The reason, quote-unquote, bad stuff happens in fashion supply chains is because of weak governance, quote-unquote, over there. Therefore, we must hold brands and retailers in the global north legally accountable for their impacts, including throughout their supply chains, primarily in the global south. In other words, those global brands and retailers are filling governance gaps, again, quote-unquote, over there. On the other hand, there's the curious case of apparel production in Leicester. Despite being in the heart of the UK, a quote-unquote developed country and leading superpower that's decidedly not, again, quote-unquote, over there, labor rights abuses in Leicester's garment sector have long been described as an open secret. This mini-series is dedicated to exploring this paradox. How is it possible that, despite strong governance and regulation, labor rights abuses have persisted in Leicester? What are the lessons and implications for our efforts to leverage legislation as a tool to fix fashion's sustainability woes globally? Each episode is a conversation with a different stakeholder group. We talk to a lawyer working on human rights abuses in Leicester, the leader of a local manufacturing association, a policy expert and government official, and a former production worker who, in recent years, has begun working in community engagement. This series has been co-created with Dr. Divya Jyoti, who some of you may remember meeting on the show before. Divya, a sustainability professional in a past life, is now a lecturer in the Department of Organization, Work and Technology at Lancaster University in the UK. She researches issues of ethics and sustainability in fashion supply chains while continuing her work with reform-oriented organizations. This mini-series has been supported by Lancaster University Management School and the Pentland Center for Sustainability and Business at Lancaster University, working in partnership with Justice in Fashion CIC, a UK-based not-for-profit that works to address imbalances of power and resources across the fashion industry supply chain. Last thing, we want this series to generate discussion and to be a two-way conversation. Share your musings, ramblings, or questions, whether fully formed or half-baked, by leaving me a voice memo or posting to our Curious Case of Leicester community wall, where you can also swap notes with fellow listeners. Links to both the voice memo and the community wall can be found in the episode description. Also, join us for a live virtual conversation on the 3rd of October to debrief and compare notes about these episodes. Spots are limited and available on a first-come, first-served basis. Links to the voice memo, community wall, and event registration page can be found in the episode description. In this episode, my co-host Dr. Divya Jyoti and I are in conversation with Shaista Jakura, a former garment worker who in recent years has been engaging with apparel workers and local community in her roles with Leicester City Council, Hope for Justice, and most recently as funding manager for the Garment and Textile Workers Trust. This episode, I should note, was recorded while Shaista was still working with the trust. After getting married and moving to the UK, Shaista's entry point into apparel production in Leicester was on the production floor. A single parent eager to build a better life for her family, Shaista ultimately left her job on the production floor to pursue higher education. She went on to work as a primary school teacher until 2020, when her career came full circle and she found herself working in community engagement for the apparel sector in Leicester. She shares her thoughts on why labor rights abuses happen in Leicester, what kind of support and solutions are needed, and how recent scrutiny has impacted people on the production floor. Well, Shaista, maybe you can start by giving us some context for what your entry point into the apparel sector was when you first encountered it and sort of what your role is within the sector now.
So I came in Leicester 31 years ago. And at that point, I was a person from the migrant communities, got married into someone who used to live in UK, When I came here, I did not know the language, did not know the mechanisms of the society. But when I came in, I never had a family here. Like, I was approached by a factory owner and she said, would you like to work? I didn't know nothing, but I knew how to use the machine. So I started to put labels in my own home.
Put labels in the garments?
On the garments. When the garment was actually manufactured in the factories. And then they sent the big bags to your homes. And they would ask you to put the labels at the back with your machine. So you put 1,000, 5,000 labels and they pay you at the end of the week. So she liked my work and then she invited me inside the factory. So I was going and she taught me how to use the industrial machine. So I was just sitting there, a very naive and very junior machinist. I did not have any speed or nothing, but I was working and she liked it because I used to finish whatever she asked me to do. So I used to have £35 a week. That was 31 years ago. So I used to go 9 o'clock in the morning, coming back home 3 o'clock or 3:30. And I was not being abused or something, but I saw a lot of things happening in the factories where the professional women were actually working there for years. And of course, they have their families and homes and they were actually coming from the morning till evening working in the factory. And at that point, I knew that I do not want my life to be like that. And I was pregnant at some point whilst I was in the factory. So I knew that I would like to learn, I would like to progress, and I would like to raise my family in a very productive way. That was something my mindset was set on. So that was my 1 year of experience within the factory as a machinist. And then I had a child and I got out of the industry. Then I raised my children, got myself educated. I went to university. By the time I went to university after 10 years, my marriage was ended as well. So I was a single parent with 4 children, 14 years after I came here. And then I went to university, started work, and then I became a teacher. And then I was working as a primary school teacher until my children all grown up and they finished their colleges, which was 4 years ago. And then I decided to move on. So I went to university and did my master's in career development and management. The only reason I took this subject on was whilst I was teacher, I was supporting the community a lot in terms of the women who were like me. Most of them were migrated from other countries, got married here, came here. Their children were coming into community schools. So I was supporting them to like do something, start your careers, come and do volunteering here in the school, learn something. And loads of women have started to learn and they become something like I did. So it was something I consider as a passion to actually support other women. After doing the master's, I had a placement at Leicester University and I got the job at Nottingham University in career consultancy. At that time, that vacancy came across, says, leading this support project for garment industry. And that was 2020. So like everything was in highlight. It was COVID era and business was booming.
You mean the garment industry business?
Exactly. So like where I live, that's called LE5 postcode in Leicester. Most of the factories are here. I could see like the factories around my house, like around my end of my streets. Loads of people, mostly women, as I said, women are going and coming back. And then there was like Annexy actually was located into the factories and people were coming and going. And it was very shocking for me because we were not even allowed to go out. So how come loads of people were working in a very tight environment? So that was the beginning of everything. Of course, it was in highlight. The government took the action. There was a project was funded by the Home Office. Project was given to Citizens Advice Bureau so that people can come to have support, advice and guides, really. And they were looking for somebody to lead that project. So it's actually striked me at that time. And I actually applied for this job and I got the job. And it was the best thing ever happened to me because it opened my eyes. And it actually provided me this opportunity where I could give back something to community. And I relate back to like loads of women that were in this situation for like decades.
Tell us a bit about what you do now.
So would you like me to actually talk about that series, what happens, or do you want me to talk about how I ended up in this job?
Well, maybe I think some context for why the job even exists would be useful, and then how you ended up in it specifically.
So I would say that was 6 months project. After 6 months, the project came to an end because there wasn't any funding by the Home Office for that. And then I was recruited by another NGO. And that NGO was like modern slavery exploitation. So I was doing the same thing. I was leading the project for 2 years with them, Hope for Justice. The Hope for Justice, there was our CEO, who was the founder trustees in the trust that was funded by the online retailer Boohoo PLC. So Boohoo is manufacturing in Leicester for like, I think from a decade or something. So like loads of factories are under contract with the Boohoo. Boohoo was in very much criticism of exploiting the workers and the owners.
So Boohoo has this scandal, winds up in the news for all of these human rights abuses in facilities that are producing for them during the pandemic.
Exactly. So in the end of the 2020, there was a workshop for all community practitioners. And in that workshop, it was myself as well. And the idea was introduced about having a trust, which was funded initially by Boohoo PLC, to support the communities in Leicester who are working in the garment and textile industry. So the benefit of this trust was that the trust was totally independent and it was run by the 6 individual trustees. To be able to actually identify the need, they have given the contract to Nottingham University. So the Nottingham University conducted a research. And then they invited us as community practitioners to actually have this sort of partnership with their research so that we can support them in identifying who to give this money to and what projects can be beneficial for the communities. So myself as Hope for Justice, I was leading the Hope for Justice in East Midlands, Shema Women's Centre, who are leading the women in Leicester. So we have supported this research and we have conducted the interviews like more than 100 people I have done and more than 100 people Shema Women's Centre did. So we approached the men and the women who are working in the garment industry and we have asked loads of questions like what is needed, what would you think that is happening and what could actually support you. So when the research was concluded and money was released for these grantees, now the trust needed a manager to actually take care of all these operations. So they were looking for somebody within the communities, the practitioners that they can lead that sort of job. And at that time, our organization decided to close down this hub. So my job came to a redundancy. And then I was approached to lead that trust, really, in March 2023. Since then, I am the manager of the Garment and Textiles Workers Trust. So my job is to identify the needs in the community and then take it to the trustees so that they can release more money for these projects to go ahead. And I am auditing or supporting the all other grantees to see how they are spending the money that we are granting them and for what projects and what is the outcome of the projects.
So in a nutshell, you have the Garment and Textiles Workers Trust, which is set up in the wake of all the Boohoo scandals and funded also by Boohoo, but managed by independent trustees. And your role now is as manager of that trust and figuring out where the money should go, what it should be spent on, what kind of projects should be done. Is that a fair summary?
Exactly. Yes. So I'm an engagement and fundraising manager. Yes.
Okay. I would be very curious first, like whether you had, before you started having all of those conversations and before you sort of re-entered the sector 4 years ago, did you have certain ideas about what people needed? Again, whether people working in production or factory owners or management. And then sort of 4 years on, hundreds of interviews later, where did you land?
The reality is a bit bitter, but it is a reality. So I knew the factory owners, the managers, because they exist in our communities, their friends, their neighbors, their friends' friends, so on. And exactly like that, I know the people who work in the factories, their friends and friends' friends. So I knew that certain challenges, how things are happening, but I, of course, didn't know at official level. I could only knew that what I was hearing. When I entered the industry and started to work, I actually identified there are a trio strategy that is all related between the workers, the brands and the factory owners. And there were actually 3 different groups that were actually functioning. So there was a one group that was the factory owners, managers and the workers, they all are privileged. So say they have children and they can claim the benefits. So what happened basically, it was like win-win situation for all of them, so that they were actually deliberately having a part-time job and getting money cash in hands that would give them this benefit of claiming the welfare benefits as well.
You mean it was a win-win for both like the factory owners and the people who were working there?
So I'm talking about three different groups of the people that I have identified. So number one was the garment workers and the factory owners.
As one group.
Perhaps managers, yeah. Win-win situation in terms of that the people who are working, they were getting benefit as well because they're working for 16 hours and they claim the benefit as well because they have children. If you don't have children in UK's welfare system, you may not get the benefit. You need to work for 30 hours. But if you have the family and if you have the children, you can claim the benefit. So if you are working for 16 hours, you can claim the benefit. These people were actually working for 16 hours and the rest of the hours they were working cash in hand, and that would go below the national minimum wage. So the factory owners can pay you £4, £5, £3.50, which is free money for you from, say, 1 o'clock till 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. So you're not paying a single penny of tax on it. And so it was benefiting the factory owners in terms of that they don't have to pay you a minimum wage, £7.50 at that time, or £10 or whatever. So they can actually getting away with paying you a little money. So it was win-win situation from both sides.
Yeah, I just want to clarify, because to illustrate the win-win, because I think there's a connect to be made. I think what you're in some way saying is that because of this arrangement, the factory owners could remain competitive in the face of demands for cheaper and cheaper fashion. And I think that's the connect, which is important to highlight. Because I think one of the things which has been raised is, and particularly because you mentioned at a time where everything was locked down, and this is something which I've questioned, you know, who are these people who were actually willing to risk their lives to produce loungewear, right? That's the way we put it. Because to allow other people to lounge in their homes, we are stepping out of the home. What you've just touched upon is how that business model perhaps became functional, because one of the reasons outsourcing happened was because there were competitive prices. And I think it was touched upon in another conversation that Leicester eventually almost was opened up as a competitive marketplace because of outsourcing. And there was this competition. But the reason Leicester remained relevant was because the fast fashion brands, which needed much quicker turnaround times, much shorter numbers in terms of styles, that's where, you know, it is often said that the structure of the industry changed from large mills, hundreds of workers, you turned into an industry where you had 10 employees, 12 employees, you know, much smaller size, people just getting, you know, machines and working. And you've just clarified in the first group that it is this underpinning which sustains that model, and why, you know, maybe brands continue to still source from those suppliers, and perhaps why that remained unexposed, because as you put it, it was a win-win.
Or an open secret, right?
Win, I wouldn't say in a positive way, Win, because when I explain win-win situation, it wasn't a positive way for somebody to earn the money in that way anyway, even if you're a what kind of worker you are, garment worker, or domestic worker, or I myself work without paying my tax. It's not, it is a positive win-win. I'm talking about everyone's having some sort of benefits. When you're talking about model, let me just go back to the model. Model at that time was any brand can come and say, who's going to create this blouse for £5.50, which is not possible to create for £5.50. But that it was just like a fish market. So who can actually create that blouse for £5.50? Of course, you are taking some cuts from somewhere. Of course, you're not paying the rightful payment to your worker. It's a chain of exploitation. It's not only between the factory owner or the manager or the garment worker. It's something that's coming from above, which needs to be addressed. It's a whole supply chain.
What you say is really interesting, because my co-founder on this show, Jessie Lee, we've tried to talk about this a few times, but it sort of makes me kind of anxious and makes my heart start to race, because I'm just so worried that we will be misunderstood. But the thing that we have tried to talk about I think, to varying degrees, and we've kind of like skirted around the issue on a couple of different episodes. You know, there's sort of a narrative in our sector that people working on the production floor, they're extremely vulnerable and they don't know what's good for them. And they're just sort of taken advantage of by people who have more power and forced into these exploitative employment situations. And there's truth, I think, to all of that. However, the other piece to that narrative, which I feel is not often talked about, and the reason I find it like it induces anxiety for me to talk about it, is that, like Jesse always says, you know, your starting point has to be that the other side is reasonable. And if their behavior appears unreasonable, then it's up to you to figure out how and why for them it's actually reasonable. And the thing that I think is really tricky in these conversations is how do you, okay, on the one hand, acknowledge the imbalance of power, acknowledge the vulnerability, but on the other hand, also acknowledge, you know, to what your point, I think, that you've just been describing, acknowledge that actually, given the sort of context, given the environment in which people are living, given this context, that this might still be a reasonable choice, you know, and I'm not saying that that makes it okay.
I understand your point, Kim. When you said vulnerability, we need to understand why the vulnerability comes with the people. People, when they come from South Asian countries, they have actually always earned. There is no concept of social or welfare benefits there. So you could do anything to earn. That's one thing. Number two is most of the population in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal, Sri Lanka, 70% of the people are under poverty level, if you like. The money they earn, they're not taxable. So they don't pay the tax and they do not receive their salary on wayslip. So they do not have that concept of these legality or understanding at all. So if these people are entering any other country, it's the job and the responsibility of the gatekeepers to actually educate them in terms of integration strategy. And that is introduced by the UK government. But how is it implementing in the different societies or different communities in a different cities? It's all very different. It shouldn't be. So once a person is coming here from anywhere, they actually have to pass the English test. And then they come to the country where they have to pass the life in UK. And then they actually integrate into the communities. And we need to understand there are certain communities in this concept, when we're talking about the garment industry, they all migrated from an area called Daman. And Daman was given the Portuguese passport in a treaty that was signed by the UK Home Office, 10 years ago. So these people were actually given the Portuguese passport. That is the reason under the European Union, they actually all came, migrated in Leicester. When they came here, they did not needed to pass the English test or life in UK. And they came from the fishmongers communities and the farmers communities. All they knew is they have relatives in Leicester and they are all working in garment factories. And they were given this sort of ideas that once you come here, you can actually have work in the garment industry.
The point that you've just shared about how they were given the passports, I think it kind of touches upon another theme in some of the conversations Kim and I have been having about trying to compensate for, you know, certain events which happened in the past, right? That's where this decision was made because Daman was a colony. And I think the decision to give the passports was almost redressing, you know, some of the, if I may, you know, refer it in that way, sins from the past. However, and I think that's what kind of is making me think about this, what is reasonable, right? And how do we define reason and why it is so difficult? And I think another point where I think your anxiety comes from, because I share that, is that if you find yourself in a particular situation, it doesn't mean that you do not have agency. You do have agency, right? And with that agency, you make a decision. And maybe that is the only choice. And maybe when you examine it, it does not appear like a reasonable choice, but that is the only choice. And it also reminds me of the point, I would say, again, in one of the other discussions in this podcast about people are only looking to survive. And that is what is the driving factor. So I think just tying it, you know, back to your point, and maybe, you know, Kim, to briefly elicit your thought around this reason and the anxiety that is triggered and this reflection on this generational inequity. And I don't know, it's not even generational, it's historic, right? Which we are kind of dealing with. And how does that pan out and play out?
Hi, sometimes I feel kind of like a madwoman sitting in my living room recording myself talk. If you want to help me with that feeling, share your musings, ramblings, or questions, whether fully formed or half-baked, by leaving me a voice memo or posting to our Curious Case of Leicester community wall, where you can also swap notes with fellow listeners. Links to both the voice memo and the community wall can be found in the episode description. Also, join us for a live virtual conversation on October 3rd to debrief and compare notes on these episodes. Spots are limited and available on a first-come, first-served basis. Register via the link in the episode description. So tell me about the second two groups.
So the second two group is that was the group that would get the benefit of the most, if you like. Whatever their thinking is, whatever, say, if you are the factory owner, you're thinking, well, if I would provide the cheaper garment to the brands, I will get the more contracts and the more quantity. And a lot of these people are young people now because their fathers have passed on the industry to them. And what they told me is just, we are actually giving the employment. So it's coming back to the point that everyone wants to earn. So they said, where we are the people who are giving the employment to our community. If we take our factory to Romania, we have the huge unemployment in our community with our own people. So this whole mentality comes back to at least no matter what, but you have to work. The second group is, say, the people who don't have the families, who don't have the children. So they can't actually get or claim the benefit. And if they are working, say, 16 hours, they won't get anything because they don't have children. So they have to work from the morning till the evening. Now, if these people are actually get paid £5, £4, £3, 50 a month, this is called struggle because they can't pay their bills. They need to have that money. So this is the group. Always they come forward. They actually raise the concerns. They become the whistleblowers because they're losing out. As I said before, the word is desperation. The third group are the illegal population, immigrants, whatever you like to say. They don't have the rights to work in UK. So this is the worst group or the worst category. They were exploited really badly because no one gave them work. So if they would like to work in the factory, they were actually given £1 or £2 because they know they can't go anywhere. They can't complain. They have to work. So for me, it was very painful to see. It was very painful to see anybody who doesn't have the rights to work in UK. And it's not only the garment factory we're talking about. This is the same stories in restaurant businesses, car washes and everywhere else. So when I came to the work in this industry and government wanted to know what are the problems and how do you identify the problems. So we had a group formed with the local governments. It was the group of the head teachers in primary school. They created this group. It's called like Leicestershire Primary Partnership, something like that. So there were loads of concerns were actually raised and it came to like child protection, safeguarding leads. So they put us into it to actually find the way and identified what is the solution of that. So therefore, we have actually, I went into the schools and I spoken to loads of parents and teachers and I identified that language is the biggest issue. Because of the language, you can't communicate, you cannot talk about your issues and you don't have confidence even in front of your children as well that you can say or communicate or put your ideas across. So what is taking for you to go and learn English is that your hours are so long in factory that you can't go and learn, number one. Number two is you didn't come from a background where there was accustomed to learn or go to school. So if you are going to learn English, you need to show your payslip because the institute they are letting you in, they would like to know if you're eligible for the free ESOL classes. And that was a huge problem in garment industry because the people were scared, they didn't have their way sleep. And above all, they are scared to actually, because they don't know the language, they are not allowed to show their way sleep to anybody. So how do we find a solution for that? So this is one thing that was addressed by the trust. And that was identified in the hundreds of interviews that we have conducted. So that was the three different groups and loads and loads of different stories. And when you are talking about the managers, so I would like to share a remediation case with you. So when in 2020, when everything was in highlighted, the brands were very strict because brands say that they never know, that they could not acknowledge what's happening in the factories. So they were cutting down the factories. They said, we're going to close down all outsourcing. So work stopped going into people's homes because they could not audit the homes. They actually closed down loads of factories and put the big factories alive so that they can monitor the factories and how things are happening. So in the process of closing down the factories, there was a factory was under the contract, and they were like CMTs, the small factories were closing down. So one manager contacted the big factory and said, look, my small factory is closing down and I have loads of like experience being owner and a manager. Would you like to recruit me as a manager? I have a workforce, so I can keep the workforce, I can keep my own factory, and I'm working under you. So it was a win-win for both of them, and he said, okay, he was a good factory owner as well. Now, what happened? In that factory, 20 women were working, and they would not know a single word of English. They would not know anything else. So there was only one woman who was from Africa. So she was from South Asian as well, but she came from Africa and her husband was very confident. So what was happening? The manager was actually telling these 20 women that the factory is going to be closed. If you can see, all factories are getting closed, but I am keeping the factory alive. And that is the reason I have merged with the big factory. But all of you have to give me some of your wages every single month so that we can have a little bit more money to run all this facility. If you're not going to give me the money, then this factory will come to close as well. And all of you will lose your job. So these 20 women were giving £250 every single month to this factory manager. And the amount was written in a little hand note and given to them. So according to what you earn this month, you need to give that person back. So they were actually giving money back. It was 3-4 months. Now, this woman's husband wasn't very happy about it. So he contacted me. And because I was working with the brand, at that particular brand, so we've contacted the brand, we contacted the factory. The factory owner was very scared if he's going to lose his contract. So he came and he opened all his books and said, look, I am paying everybody with the thumb. There's no possibility that anything happening from our end. So the brand was actually satisfied. We did interview, did loads of things. And then it come to like 20 people who were actually giving money to the manager. The manager was caught. Actually, we've been taken interviews and we've taken back to the factory owner and we said, somehow it was duty of care for you. So this woman was given the money back as well for like how many months the money was taken. And then we have actually contacted the 19 other women to come forward as well so that they can get their money back. And this manager can be proceed, like police can actually question them or prosecute them. But these 19 women were not very confident. They wouldn't know the language and they were treating this manager as a god. He said, no, he's given us the job. He's allowing us our religious rituals and we can't go against him. And they actually denied because they could not speak and they wouldn't know what was going to happen in next step. So they all lost the money. They lost the job. The man was prosecuted. The CMT unit was closed down. And all of these things happened. As you said, you were a manager and you wanted to know more about how things were happening.
I want to ask you because, and then Divya, I want you to share your thoughts if you'd like. But before the pandemic and in the early days of the pandemic, business was booming for the apparel sector. And then there were all of these scandals, media exposés, and then there was a huge shrinking of the industry in Leicester. And as a result of that, and tell me if I'm getting it wrong, but then as a result of that, a lot of the smaller facilities closed down and only the big ones survived. And that was in part because it was perceived, I guess, by the brands or maybe by government, I'm not sure, that the bigger factories were easier to monitor, easier to audit, easier to sort of make sure that they were operating in a certain way and compliant. On the other hand, what you're saying is that actually the biggest need from your perspective that people had was to learn the language. And so all of this like oversight and consolidation that happened in the sector, which was allegedly because it was going to make workplaces better places to work in, wasn't actually addressing the biggest gap, which was language. Is that a fair summary or not?
It wasn't the language only.
Okay.
It was the employment rights. And because of the language, if you are calling citizens advice, you have to be on the line for like, I don't know how many hours, because you don't have that interpreter available for you. So it wasn't the only language this is affecting directly. It's affecting in many different aspects.
There have been challenges in Leicester. And as you keep referring to it, it has been an open secret. I think with the pandemic, things came to a head and there were lots of initiatives which were put in place. But what has emerged in this conversation, to go back to the language point, is that while there were various measures, the key to be able to access those measures was the language barrier. One was limiting the ability to access, but was also making people more and more vulnerable because that was the way they couldn't engage. But I think the takeaway for that is, alongside listening and understanding, it is important to see the interconnections and the dependencies and the relationships, which then makes me think that legislation cannot be acontextual. When we want to come up with these, you know, either private regulatory approaches in the forms of codes and standards and other initiatives, multi-stakeholder initiatives, or the push to, you know, hold firms to account by having laws in place, it is important to think about the, again, the point embeddedness of it and where it is being, you know, played out. And I think the underlying factors of the drivers perhaps needs much more questioning, because the reason we started examining Leicester is because it is a curious case, right? Where you have all these strong governance frameworks, yet these exploitation is happening. I think in this conversation, it has emerged why that exploitation continues to happen. And unless we think about and reflect on that, no amount of legal frameworks alone will necessarily enable us to, you know, have a more ethical sector.
Sorry, I'm just going to come back to what Divya has just said. And that is, did you mention a strong governance in Leicester and why the exploitation is thriving? What concept we have made this statement? If we have this strong governance, how the exploitation is thriving? That's number one. And now if the exploitation is in progress or in process of elimination, then why we have massive redundancies? So in before the research and everything happened, there were 10,000 workers, garment workers, were working in Leicester. And now they are under 2,000 workers or three, two to three, not more than that. So have we failed to bring the positive change? Have we failed to bring sustainability? And if we haven't, then why we have lost all the work that was happening in Leicester? And apparently said Leicester is a very expensive place.
I'm going to note for listeners the air quotes that you've put around that. Expensive, right?
Exactly. So this is not one or two I'm talking about. All brands are actually taking the work outside Leicester or the other countries in UK, I'm not sure. The one thing I was talking about is Divya is very aware of. There was a huge body that was come to exist. I don't know. I mean, it was 2017 or what, but was working very actively. It's called AGMPPP, a public and private protocol. And that body, everyone was sitting, the local government, the law enforcement bodies, the brands, the community practitioners, the academics, and everyone was sitting there sharing their ideas how to bring sustainability and positive change. And as we can just see, we're coming out of these couple of years, the bodies disappeared, the groups who were helping Leicester, they all disappeared. With that all disappearance, the work is disappeared. That is something very, very sad to see. So are we the people who can influence the policy maker and doing this old work and talks and research and then action? Are we actually talking about this exploitation and we are managed to let the exploitation go? However, alongside that exploitation, the work itself goes as well. Because I think we fail to address, we have identified the factors. But whilst we are in process of identifying what are the solutions are in front of us, but we cannot sustain it and actually we decided to take the work away.
Can you give an example of a solution just to make this concrete?
This is becoming very political, becoming very subjectifying, so I don't want to mention any names. But as I said, if the actual problem is addressed by the hierarchy from the top to bottom, then it's actual addressing the problem. If we are trying to addressing something from the very bottom, there is reason we're failing.
So let me make sure I've understood. Is what you're saying that, you know, there were a lot of efforts and work in the lead up to 2020 to try and address some of these issues in the garment sector in Leicester that brought various stakeholders together around the table? Then there was all the media exposés, the scandals, everything hit the news during the pandemic. Is what you're saying that then after that, the industry left Leicester for the most part, and that there's a lot of unemployment as a result?
An audit system was introduced fast forward, and every business was encouraged to adopt that. And there was a scrutiny of audit by this system fast forward,
which was supposed to make the industry more sustainable.
Exactly. So that if you are pass all of these checks and you're audited by fast forward, then other brands can give you work as well. So that was all happened, and all the small businesses passed that. They paid, I don't know how many thousand pounds to be on this system. When everything was actually set in, and in April 2023, the national minimum wage went up. The prices they were set with the small businesses in manufacturing by the brand, they didn't go up.
I see. So in a way, what happened was, okay, there were these new measures that were introduced that were supposed to make these places better places to work, that were supposed to do something about the exploitation, but the broader context wasn't really addressed, which was the fact that the prices were too low.
Therefore, the small businesses took their businesses to Morocco and Turkey, because then they can produce whatever they're producing in Leicester can be produced in somewhere else to meet the demand of the brands and the retailers. Therefore, the Leicester is facing huge redundancies, and loads of factories are actually closing down. They're just like sort of ghost towns now. I can just go past every single day. They're closed. They got big, big locks on it. And these people are looking for work. They don't have any other skills that they can go and find. And remember that like 89% of the workforce were the women. And women from certain culture, from South Asian community, it's an anxiety for a woman to go out very far to find the work. Women don't feel comfortable to go and work with other culture, men and women. They have like language issues, they have confidence issues. They know certain things and they don't know certain things. That is the reason they were finding it very comfortable to work within their communities. So that is all come to that conclusion that people don't have work and they can't find the work because they don't have other skills. This is why I like my job, and this is the reason I like what the trust is doing, because this is a power without industrial action. So then still we are being able to support the community, having upskilling themselves, learn different skills, learn the language, and learn other skills and their own businesses. We're helping them start their own businesses as well, the sewing business, because they have these skills.
I think I could talk to you about this for hours and never run out of questions. I feel there's still so much I don't know and don't understand. But I want to close the conversation by asking both you, Divya, and you, Shaista, if there's anything that you'd like to say that you haven't had a chance to say.
Honestly, I was making notes as you were speaking, and the only point coming to my mind is that no amount of legislative approaches or governance frameworks focused on business practices or behaviors alone will deliver their intended objectives if the underlying business model or the driving factors are not addressed. And I think that's my takeaway from the last bit of what Shaista has just highlighted, that there is a cost of that legislation and that improvement, or the cost of ethical production, which kind of for me resonates.
That's kind of what I'm thinking too. And Shaista, I don't know if this resonates with you, but it's like, we've done all of this stuff to try and make this sector more sustainable, and not only to sort of end the exploitation, and not only is it not working, it's actually causing harm.
I remember one thing. So I met like a family of three sisters are living in this family, and they actually said to me, three of us lost the job. So I wish that things were they were before in exploitation, and we were all earning £4.50, £4 an hour, three of us together, that's £12, £13 an hour. But now we can't pay the rent and we are thinking about moving with somebody else because we have no job. So who cares? And why do you guys even come to us and ask us questions? Because of you guys, this is all happened. And our work is gone. Our livelihoods is gone. We don't know what else to do. And now we can't even afford what we used to afford before. That was very sad for me. And I questioned myself, have I done anything right in last 4 years? Because people are in this situation. So there are loads of questions, as Divya said, we need to ask ourselves and we need to ask policymakers that how do we influence them and how do we bring the positive change without harming people and their livelihoods, really.
All right. Thank you, Shaista, and thank you, Divya, for this conversation. Thank you for listening to Manufactured. I've been your host, Kim van der Weert, and if you learned something new from this episode and want to support the show, come say hi to me on LinkedIn. Also, share your musings, ramblings, or questions about this episode, whether fully formed or half-baked, by leaving me a voice memo or posting to our Curious Case of Leicester community wall, where you can also swap notes with fellow listeners. Also, join us for a live virtual conversation on the 3rd of October to debrief and compare notes about these episodes. Spots are limited and available on a first-come, first-served basis. Links to the voice memo, community wall, and event registration page can be found in the episode description. And of course, subscribe, rate, and review us on the podcast app you're listening to this episode on.